Hello and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to talk about all aspects of everything to do with death and dying. Today I'm talking to Catherine Beer, who we've spoken to before on a couple of these podcasts. Catherine, you're a pastoral care worker, and I've come really to ask you about that trickiest of subjects today. How do we talk to and what do we say to someone who's dying?
Yes, in my role in pastoral care at the hospice, I was so privileged to have had an incredible amount of conversations with people who were dying, who were approaching the end. And it's addressing so much, isn't it, that people are frightened of addressing. And I think that is quite true of the topic that we're looking at today. Talking to someone who's dying can be really frightening, not just for the person doing the talking, but for the person who's receiving that conversation as the patient. And I think it's always really important to listen firstly. It's not looking at what can I say, maybe how can I listen, because we very much want to find out how it is. How are you feeling today? Are you frightened? And being able to talk to somebody on a one-to-one basis helps them feel that they can really be open and honest, because I think someone who's dying quite often is scared and quite often doesn't want to tell their family and their friends that they're scared, because they can see how sad and upset their family and friends are, understandably, that the end of life is approaching for them. And it's interesting, I've often had quite a lot of answers. One answer quite often is, I'm scared of actually dying. And I know that you did recently, near the beginning, I think, you did an episode with Catherine Gilbert, didn't you, from the hospice, who talked a lot about the dying process.
Yes.
And, you know, when I worked at the hospice, I learned such a lot from the medical team. And I think giving them permission to feel scared is important, because we can't stop the fact that they feel scared. So we have to allow that to happen and allow them to voice it. And, you know, maybe it's about saying, I can understand how frightened you are, but there are people here who are with you through that fear, through that anxiety. I think that it's a human instinct to maybe say to somebody, oh, you don't need to be frightened. But actually, it's not for us to say what they need or don't need. If they feel frightened, they feel frightened.
Because it is the unknown.
Absolutely. It's something that until you get to it, no one has experienced. So, you know, I couldn't sit next to someone who was dying and think, well, I don't know what you're frightened of. I'm not them. And I think, you know, physical touch for somebody who is dying, just holding their hand or stroking their hair, because that's a real comfort. Our words can comfort people, but I think our physical touch is as important. And so I would spend quite a lot of time just listening to somebody. I'm frightened, they would say, I'm frightened of dying. Some people would say, I don't want to leave my family. Understandably, I'm frightened for my family. Some people would say to me, I'm not frightened of dying, but I'm frightened for my family. So they were really torn, because quite a lot of people that I had the privilege of talking with would be in a position where they were at peace about what was happening, but sad for their family. So it was a bit of a conflict for them inside. And so I think the reassurance that their family would be looked after. And, you know, I used to toy with the idea of, do you say to somebody, oh, don't worry, your family will be okay? Because actually, at the beginning, the family probably won't be okay, because they're going to be so devastated. And also, don't say to someone, don't worry, because it's a natural feeling for us to worry, isn't it? So it's just reassurance, really. I would reassure them. Yeah, I know you're worried, I know you're scared, and I know that your family will be really sad, but there are lots of people here who will be with them, who will walk alongside them, some people would, as patients, would want to tell me things that they hadn't ever told anyone before. And that was a huge privilege for me, to be trusted with things. And in that situation, again, it is a case of just listening. Because I couldn't change what they were telling me. I couldn't change what happened. But they just needed to let go of that.
What kind of things are you talking about?
So some people would tell me things maybe that they'd done in their past that they felt guilty about, that they felt ashamed about, so much so that they'd carried it through life and not told anybody. And for some people, it was almost like one last putting everything into place so that they could be ready to die. Offloading, you know, I didn't go into my job from a chaplaincy point of view, but it was almost that level sometimes when someone was unburdening themselves. And you could see the sense of relief on their face. You could see them relax. And sometimes you would see that the dying process then took place because they were letting go of things and they could just relax. And I spent a lot of time sitting with people who were quite far, far forwards in the dying process. So maybe they had become unresponsive and I would sit with them, maybe with their families present as well, or sometimes if they were on their own before family had come in that day, and just talk to them. Because, you know, I'm sure I recall Catherine Gilbert mentioning this in her podcast, that even though someone becomes unresponsive, they can still hear you. And I've seen evidence of that in my work. You know, you talk to somebody and you see a facial recognition of a voice or an eyebrow raise at an appropriate moment. I just think it's really important to continue treating them as a human being with respect and compassion, holding their hand, reassuring them, you're not on your own, I'm here with you. Your wife or husband will be here soon, but I'm just going to sit with you for a while, and beautiful sunshine today, and all of those sorts of things, because they're still living, even though they're near the end. And I think, you know, continuing to talk to someone all the way through is so important, because it helps with that feeling of fear and that feeling of loneliness maybe for them.
And do you find you get lots of questions about what it's going to be like? How am I going to die? What's going to happen to me? Will I know I'm dying? Yeah. Will I know the time's come? All those things.
Lots and lots of those questions. We were asked a lot. Will I be in pain? Will it hurt? Will I know? And will my family know? Lots and lots of questions. People are very much wanting to know what it's going to be like. And I mean, I keep referring back to Catherine, but her podcast episode was so brilliant about describing it and explaining it, wasn't it? And I picked up so much from that, from her podcast, but from my years of working at the hospice, and also through my own lived experience of being with my dad as he was approaching the end of life, that there are all those physical changes. I think it's really important to explain that to the patient, because it does take away fear. And predominantly, the pain is extremely low, because wherever they are, hospice, home, hospital, the medical staff that are there or have been supporting them if they're at home, will be working really hard on the pain levels, won't they, and keeping them low, so that family can concentrate and focus on sitting with them. But there often are questions about what's it going to be like. Often people will say to me, where am I going to go? And that was a really hard question for me to answer, because, you know, my role as a pastoral care worker, it was all encompassing. It was emotional, psychological and spiritual, on whatever level the patient would want that support. And so it was a really interesting question that it made me think a lot about. How would I answer that? and being very careful about not to bring in what I think or believe. It's about the person in front of me. And I would often say to them, where would you like to think you're going to go? Where would you like to be? Do you have a favourite place? And I remember one woman had a lot of conversations with me about this particular matter. She was fairly young, she was mid-50s, and we talked and talked and talked about it. And eventually she said, you know what, I think I'm just going to believe that I'm going to go to where my favourite place is in the whole world. And I said, that's beautiful. Where is that? She said, it's in my school playground.
Oh,
when I was 9, and I used to play under one of the trees, and that's where I'm going to be. And that gave her such comfort when she finally almost put that piece of the puzzle into place. And I learned a lot from that those conversations with her. Where would you like to be? Where's your favourite place? Where would you feel you're connected? And quite a lot of answers come back. Most of the answers come back concerning nature, interestingly.
And do you find it's very different when you're dealing with, say, the elderly who have had long, long lives and are expecting that their time has come, as opposed to somebody really young who's just had a diagnosis of cancer or something and a short time left to live?
That is a really difficult question, I think, because both ends of the spectrum, both ends of age, I suppose, for want of a better phrase, can approach the end of life quite similarly. Because someone who is older, maybe in their 80s or 90s, I can remember sitting with people who would be really frightened of dying, not wanting to die, even maybe, let's just pluck a number out of the age of 85. I don't want to die because I've lived for 60 odd years with my husband. I don't want to leave him. And I get that. I do empathise with that and I hear that. And yet someone who is younger, maybe 20s or 30s, is similarly going to feel, I don't want to die. I've got all my life to live. So there are different approaches, but both incredibly sad. And, you know, an older person would say, oh, I won't get to see my granddaughter marry. I won't get to see. And I'm sure you can empathise with that. And I know that younger people, you know, and I know that you've had Jess Seymour on recently, was very privileged to be involved with her and Matt very closely when he was in the hospice care.
He was about 35.
Yeah, he was.
Very young.
And so he and I would sit and have lots of conversations, actually, and the majority of his conversation was around not being there with Jess to watch Elijah grow up. And so there's this, it's similar, but it's different, isn't it?
It's so understandable, though, isn't it? You're leaving a small child.
Absolutely.
You'd want them to know more about you than you have probably got time to tell them, wouldn't you?
And interesting, just thinking about my conversations with younger people, but equally with older people as well, I would often say to them, we would talk a lot about what is it you would like to say to your family if this wasn't the situation and life was to carry on for you. What would you want to say to them? How would you speak to them? What do you want to leave for them? And that would bring out some interesting conversations. And sometimes I've been privileged enough to be part of letter writing. You know, patients would write down letters for loved ones and we would pass them on when that person has died. And so that there were also conversations that I would have with somebody about what would you like to say? How would you like to say goodbye? And being open and honest and talking about it.
And I don't know how much experience you've had of actually being around people in the hospice when they die, but I was very struck by something Catherine McLaughlin said. We keep referring back to early episodes, don't we? But she said that her husband said to her at one point, I'm going now. He seemed to know quite clearly that, and 10 minutes later he had died. Does that happen often?
I haven't experienced it happening often, but I have seen it happen on an odd occasion, and it is quite phenomenal. I think the human body is remarkable, and people's spirit is remarkable as well. I think I've seen more often than that situation you explain, I've seen more often people holding on, either holding on to see somebody or holding on to be by themselves. I've seen that happen. You know, I've been privileged enough in my role at the hospice in the past to be able to provide end of life prayers and blessings for a patient at either the patient's request or the family's. And quite often, fairly soon after that has happened, the person will die. And it's almost like the family are giving that person permission to go, to leave. And I think, you know, I've also seen and heard of if a relative says to somebody who's dying, it's okay to go. It's okay to go. That has also been the situation where that has then happened fairly quickly. And that's when I realise that someone does hear you all the time. And also that the human spirit is incredibly strong and independent, I suppose, for want of a better phrase, because, you know, the person is being given permission and allowed to do this their way.
I've heard that before, people mm-hmm. saying that they waited till I left the room mm-hmm. or waited till we'd gone home.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, but understandably, that was one of the most distressing things for somebody. I totally, totally understand that. Because relatives desperately want to be with their loved ones, obviously. But yes, you know, someone can sit by a bedside for days and nip to the bathroom or nip to get a glass of water, and they come back in the room and the person has died. And it causes such a lot of pain and distress. But I've sat with people after that's happened and they are really sad and obviously crying an awful lot. And I have just tried to comfort them and reassure them and say, but what you did was that was the last thing you could do for them, was you let them do it their way. You let them take control and choose. And actually, that was a kind thing to do for them. But it is quite remarkable when that happens.
So it's interesting to think that we have a bit of a say in our own death, isn't it?
I really believe that. I've seen it so many times. You know, I saw it with my dad. It, absolutely no doubt in my mind, he died when he did because he was a minister and he had wanted his own minister to come and do a blessing. So we called him in. And within 20 minutes, Dad died. You know, I just had visions of him sort of probably lying there thinking, oh, goodness, could you just call the vicar? Because I'm ready. I mean, I joke about it, but, you know, I do think it's important to remember what people have said they'd like and to respect those decisions and, yeah, allow them to make those choices.
So can we come on now to how a family should handle somebody who's got somebody dying in their midst, no matter what age they are. Mm. I don't suppose that's particularly relevant. It's awfully hard to know what to say, whether to talk about it or not, whether to pretend it's not happening. Also, because, of course, people sort of come in and out of consciousness, don't they?
Yes.
So what's your best advice?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one because I think families will be at different stages as each other. So you may have, let's just maybe have an example of a dad who's married and has grown up children. Everyone's at different stages of maybe acceptance of the ability to spend time with that person. Because yes, it's frightening for the patient at times about what's happening to them, but equally for relatives, it's terribly frightening, distressing. Some relatives can't be in the room because by being in the room, you accept what's happening, and you don't want to accept what's happening because this is your parent. For the partner of the patient, it's a whole different level of grief going on as that approaches, isn't it? Because it's a different relationship. But I think it's, you know, I just feel so passionately about encouraging people to be as normal as you possibly can. Sit round the bed, hold their hands, laugh, joke, banter, as well as cry. I think it's important to cry. Some people say to me, I can't cry in the room because I don't want him or her to know that I'm sad. But it's okay for them to know you're sad because you are. It's all right to acknowledge the sadness. It's an incredibly sad situation. But I'm sure through life, there were a lot of times when as a family, you would laugh, you would joke, take the mickey out of somebody, sit and have a cup of tea all together, or sometimes just sit in silence. And I think one of the most important things to do is just to sit with them. And I mean, it's a strange phrase, isn't it? But go with it. If you feel like talking, talk. Maybe say, I saw so-and-so at the shops today, and or we're going to have pizza for tea tonight, or we're going to watch this on the telly with you tonight. We're going to pop it on and you can listen if you want to, or you can sleep if you want to, but we'll just all be together. Maybe if you're sitting up and if you're keeping, if either a hospice or a hospital or a home, families will, you know, the closer you get to the end of life for somebody, families will more often than not keep some sort of rota going so that somebody's with them all the time. That's incredibly beautiful to watch from a staff point of view. When I was at the hospice, I found that very moving when I would see that happening. And I think that, you know, doing that, you have some very special time with your loved one at that point. You can read to them, you know, particularly if they're unresponsive. You know, I've seen people reading and I've seen them putting their heads down on the bed, on the pillow, just having a little snooze, holding their hand. And I've also encouraged families to say to their the patient, tell them that you love them. Say thank you. If there's things you want to say thank you for, if there's things you want to say sorry for, say sorry. Because as blunt as this might sound, you don't get a second chance. You've got one chance at doing this, and each day counts. So maybe it's about looking at, again, like I say to the patient, what would you like to say to your loved ones? What would you like to leave with them? Saying to the relative, what would you like to say? And I have sat and said to people, you won't get a second chance at this. Say the things you want to say, because afterwards, and as things move forwards, I really hope that you don't have regrets over what you wanted to have said and you didn't. And sometimes for people that's really hard, because it's, you know, there are so many people who say to me, well, I don't want them. Yeah, I don't want them to die. Of course you don't. Even if you accept it, you don't want it. And that's a real conflict in emotions, isn't it? Because if you love somebody, you always want them to be there. So I think you, like I said earlier about someone who was dying, they can accept that they're dying, but they don't want to. I think the same goes for the family.
I think it's probably different in a hospice, isn't it? Because once you've gone into a hospice, you assume the patient is aware, the end is near, and you assume the family would also recognise that. But if they're in hospital and they're really unwell, and the medical staff aren't necessarily being all that upfront and frank with you. It's that was the period I found most difficult, if I'm talking about myself, that sort of 2 or 3 weeks when I hoped they were making my husband better and he would come home with me. But they seem to be talking on a different level eventually. Then it's really hard to know what to say to the patient. It's hard to know what to say in front of the patient.
Absolutely.
And the doctors weren't all that sensitive, I have to say.
No. And interestingly enough, we have heard that quite a lot. and that's quite sad. I would sort of say maybe in that situation, if someone is in hospital, about maybe saying to the patient, what do you think's happening? Do you have questions about what's happening? How do you think you are? How are you feeling? Because I think sometimes a patient knows quicker than medical staff know. And I do accept that it is much harder in a hospital because I suppose psychologically, if you go into hospital, you're going into a hospital to be made better, aren't you? And then you're going to come home again. Psychologically, if you go into a hospice, on the whole, not all the time, but on the whole, it's to spend your end of life. So you're right, it is very, very different. And quite often I imagine relatives of somebody in a hospital are tired, they're frightened, they're scared. As you say, sometimes medical staff are not forthcoming with updates or information, and it can feel quite isolating, can't it?
But also they're very happy to talk in front of the patient. Mm. And if hearing is the last sense that goes, sometimes I wonder if what they say is appropriate.
I would absolutely agree. And that was one of the things that we were always told at the hospice and we always practiced. Don't have sensitive conversations in the room. You take them out of the room. Or if you are talking to everybody in the room, you include the patient. You talk to them by name and you look at them while you're talking to them, even if they appear to not be responsive, because sometimes they are lying there with their eyes shut, but they're very aware of what's happening and they will sometimes then join in verbally. And I've seen people really taken aback when that happens. I think it's a lesson. Yes.
That's such a good lesson because
it's huge.
You must include people in a conversation about their own
absolutely.
Life and death.
Absolutely.
You? But I've seen it not happen.
Yeah. And I have seen it not happen in hospitals. And I've heard many stories about it not happening in hospitals. And I think there's a lot of, it puts a lot of, pressure, for want of a different word, a better word, sorry, for relatives who are struggling already to have to fight their corner. And I only hope that through things like this podcast and other people's educating, that can improve. Remembering that a patient is a human being, whatever level their responsiveness is, their awareness is, their understanding, they have to be included in conversations all the way through to the end. All the way through to the end.
I just desperately hope that if people remember nothing else from this podcast, they remember that single nugget, because I think that's so important. Mm.
Very much so. Very much so.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for sharing all that wisdom with us.
Thank you again, Dilys, for asking me to take part. I think this podcast series is amazing, and I'm sure it's been very helpful for everyone who's listened.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.